Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast episode titled Moving Towards a Patient-Centered Approach in NMIBC Management. I'm Dr. Max Cates. I'm a urologist and associate professor of urology and the director of urologic oncology at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland.
Hi, everyone. I'm Neil Shore. I'm a urologist at the Carolina Urologic Research Center. I'm based in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
So today we will discuss the impact of long-term care in the quality of life of patients with NMIBC and highlight some of the treatment advances that may support a better experience for our patients. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Katie Murray, a urologic oncologist at NYU Langone Health and professor at the Department of Urology at NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City. Katie, thanks so much for joining us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I look forward to hanging out and talking and chatting with you guys about NMIBC and our patients.
So let's jump right in. You know, one of the things that I think about, and I'd love to hear both of your thoughts with intermediate risk NMIBC, are really the long-term issues. Okay, this is almost by definition of the disease state of recurrent cancer. And so, it's sometimes it's a one and done, and you know, we count ourselves lucky with the patients, but oftentimes it's not, and we're dealing with long-term care and effects. And I'm just curious, Katie, from your perspective, and then Neil as well. You know, what have you found sort of most challenging about these long-term issues for patients and their families?
So I think there's a couple of things. You know, I think from the get-go, something that really falls on our shoulders as urologists when you first diagnose these patients is really to set the stage for them that this, you know, I'll say it's more of a chronic disease than a cancer, right? Obviously it's a cancer, but when people think of cancer and then when they think of cancer recurrences, that often, you know, is life-changing and world-changing. And oftentimes for these low-risk or these low-grade intermediate risk patients, that's not necessarily the case, right? This is a very, you know, I'll quote to patients, it can be a very annoying cancer, and it often does not lead to your death, but will impact your life and what you do on a regular basis, and basically tell them up front that they're stuck with me and that we're going to become very close friends. With clinic appointments, multiple cystoscopies, procedures that are gonna last a lifetime. So I think setting that stage is probably the first thing that I try to do. But then every time you see those patients thereafter and they have those recurrences, we kind of go through this same, you know, everything kind of gets rebrought up again and you have that same discussion over and over. And it is tolling on their lives. It's, you know, they get anxiety a week before, maybe a month before they come in for that follow-up, for you to take a look in the bladder.
Yeah, that's so well said. The amount of anticipatory anxiety in these patients, I really like the way you've sort of couched it with them that yes, technically we call this a cancer, but the biggest hassle for you, you know, Mr. or Mrs. X, is that you're going to have a risk for recurrence. And it's such a very low, but it's real, the low single digit percentage of progression. And it's this hassle and annoyance of the recurrence. And that's probably one of the biggest factors contributing to that often heard statement, oh, bladder cancer is one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive solid tumor, given its prevalence and how we manage it. So I think there's some really good things we can talk about from, you know, either active surveillance in some of these patients to office-based biopsying and fulguration, some of the new therapies that are coming out that could potentially obviate, you know, the need for recurrent TURBT, not necessarily replace it, but obviate this excessive cycle of TURBTs, which leads to a lot of problems. So I like the way you frame it. I think, you know, all cancers are not alike, and certainly the spectrum of bladder cancer is very varied.
Yeah, I mean, that's so well said from both of you. I know I use different analogies with patients. You know, I sometimes I'll say this is a marathon, you know, not a race. You know, we're other times I'll say, you know, we're going to be married for a long time. I hope it's a happy marriage, you know, whatever you're going to frame it. I think setting the stage that this is not going to be a short-term thing and it is going to be more of like a chronic disease is really important in that partnership. Katie, you know, Neil started to touch on this with some of the toxicities of TURBT that I think, you know, maybe you don't realize when you're a trainee and you're doing it for about 30, 45 minutes. But then, you know, when you're seeing a patient after their fourth or fifth TURBT and they're getting up three, four times a night and they're on mirabegron and they're on mirabegron and it's not helping. And you know, it's kind of a disaster. You know, at some point in some patients, you realize that TURBT long-term has a lot of effects. How do you balance kind of controlling recurrences, disease progression, you know, with treatments, either surgical treatments or medical treatments?
Sure. I think it really comes down to kind of talking to the patients up front. Now, in my practice, I do obviously office-based cystoscopy, and I do a lot of biopsies and fulgurations in the office for intermediate risk patients. And I think a lot of times they have anxiety the first time or the second time. But as time goes on, they'll say, oh, are you going to buzz that little spot? Or, you know, they recognize it immediately when you kind of see that. And where things are from that perspective. So I use that. I actually also have historically, you know, I don't say it purposefully, but we'll use somewhat of an active surveillance protocol, right? When I have somebody who has some small tumors and I know they're going to continue to recur, and I'm trying to just push that TURBT that they're going to need maybe down the road and they're going on vacation or something, right? We fit it into life. And I say, oh, just come back and we'll schedule it in 3 to 6 months. This is not a surgery that has to be done tomorrow. And in 3 to 6 months, right, do we take on a little risk of a progression? But in this continually recurrent patient, I think it's pretty safe. And they feel comfortable with that at the same time. And so by default, you know, we do these short spurts of active surveillance, I think, for, you know, low grade intermediate risk patients. All of that being said, we do have to take people to TURBT. Tumors are in locations that can't have office fulgurations. Patients sometimes don't tolerate it. And for one reason or another, and I think you're right, Max, we have to take caution. And, you know, people, they'll count and say, oh, this is my eighth time, or this is my, you know, 12th time in the last 8 years, or, you know, and they know it off the top of their head. And I do think that we probably underestimate the buildup of impact and the scarring of how much we're impacting a patient's bladder by doing that, right? Because we see those scars when you do a cystoscopy. You see all of the little starbursts of where you've previously removed those tumors. And it definitely is weighing against a quality of life. And if we probably dig down and really ask our patients, they have a lot more urinary symptoms than we listen to on a regular appointment basis, or they tell us about, because they just deal with it because they're is no, or historically has been not a great other option.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then there's always that moment when they have early and frequent recurrences and they look at you and they say, so you mean you didn't get it all? And you guys,
sure.
No, I promise you, I resected everything I saw. And then having that conversation, but you know, It does speak to the issue of the complexity and the heterogeneity of this patient population and how we can try to minimize unnecessary or avoidable TURBT, because in addition to that, you know, scarring and impact on detrusor function, you know, we still have the occasional perforations and delayed bleeding and hospitalizations and you're in catheter use for a day or two or three and concomitant urinary infections. And again, that speaks back to the cost prohibitiveness of this disease and where we can do better. And so I think we're all pretty excited ultimately of some alternative therapies. And I'm sure, Katie, you're doing a ton of those trials at Langone and at NYU. And I know Max is, and I think you're both spearheading a lot of these. And I think that's an exciting opportunity. In addition to getting our colleagues to recognize some of the risk stratification for these patients who need therapy or don't need a TURBT or could get away with some surveillance or office-based therapy.
Yeah, so let's take that cue from Neil and just jump right in. So given what we've talked about with these complications of TURBT and some of the issues, frankly, with repetitive TURBTs over a patient's lifetime, what are some of the emerging treatments for patients with intermediate risk NMIBC that you're particularly excited about and that may give us some alternatives to sort of this, I'll just use the hamster wheel we're kind of on with patients in this disease state.
Sure. I think, you know, it's exciting for intermediate risk bladder cancer, and it's a really cool time to be in the bladder cancer world because we do have a focus on patient impact and quality of life, right? For this. So I think, you know, probably the most one that's completed trials would be with UGN-102 with mitomycin hydrogel into the bladder as a pure chemo ablation that, you know, you have a visible tumor and you can use it as a pure chemo ablation in an office-based setting, very familiar to what we do as urologists. We understand putting in catheters and putting chemotherapy in bladders. And quite honestly, our patient population that, you know, have had these, they're also familiar with that. They're not strangers to catheters and chemotherapeutics in the bladder. And so I think avoiding the operating room in a scenario like that can be very exciting. And then, of course, you know, there's a plethora of clinical trials that are out there now that are with and without TURBT, you know, and really looking at that complete response and durability of response. And patients are asking for these things, right? That patient that has the repetitive, you know, recurrences, or as Neil talked about, that person who just feels like they get recurrence right there in a quick time frame. And they're saying, well, what did you do wrong this time, Dr. Murray? You know, and I say, I promise I did everything that I could. The disease failed us yet again, right? And that's where some of these new therapies, even in intermediate risk and in trials, can be exciting. Maybe we can get an extended durability of response for intermediate risk patients.
Yeah, I just want to ask a follow-up question to you on UGN-102, because, you know, you have a quite a large experience, I think. I don't want to put you on the spot with this drug for upper tract disease. And I think, you know, many urologists may not, you know, have that same experience, but treat, you know, low-grade papillary tumors in the bladder all the time. So right. Just curious, you know, I know it's given in a different, little bit different route, but it's still given in an ablative intention. So just curious what your experience has been, you know, in that, you know, as we think about, you know, potentially giving it in the bladder if they should have a FDA approval.
Sure. So I think the first thing that I remind people is that chemo ablation of papillary tumors or urothelial cancer is not a brand new concept, right? You go back even into the 1980s, you know, there has been chemo ablation trials with this attempt for patients that can't go to the operating room. And so it's definitely a concept that is a little bit foreign to us, especially in the United States as urologists of wrapping our heads around. But you're right. I have an experience of using that in low-grade upper tract urothelial carcinoma. And, you know, it's a unique setting where it does, you know, I tell patients almost defy gravity, right? It allows the kidney to be, for a short period of time, a storage organ. Instead of transporting urine, it holds it for it, you know, holds that chemotherapeutic for a period of time to allow for that chemo ablation. And I've had a very positive experience as far as patient tolerability with it being the mitomycin. That's always a question that I get. And personally, I've had a low side effect profile in putting it directly into the kidney. And in that patient that with true low-grade disease, that papillary appearing tumor, the response, I think, you know, the first couple of times that I saw it, I was, you know, fairly surprised and shocked of what that chemoablation actually looks like afterwards. You know, I just did one the other day of an upper tract and took some pictures and was, you know, bragging about it with the residents and making sure they all saw it, because it is a very cool idea. But like you said, right, a lot of people don't see low-grade upper tract urothelial carcinoma, but every urologist sees low-grade recurrent bladder cancer. The concept of chemoablation isn't new. And so it'll be really exciting, because it's going to give all these urologists a chance, if they're approved, to try this in this patient population that's really wanting something else.
I totally Katie's comments about using the Urogen product in the upper tract, all based on this really wonderful Olympus trial. And it's been approved. And the only thing holding us back at the very beginning was just getting our reimbursements down. Now we're, I think, 99.9%. So we've used it a fair amount. We have a pretty large practice in the upper tract. And the chemoablative story is not a new story. And mitomycin is a very effective chemoablative agent. What's kind of cool about the reverse gel technology, comes in chilled, comes in as a solid, body warms it up, and it's urinated out. So you get that better dwell time in the bladder, similar to the upper tract. And it's intravesically catheter-based. And there's so many other interesting trials similar with catheter-based in the clinic. It's not a standalone. I mean, in the intermediate risk group, and definitely in the BCG naive and in the high risk BCG refractory. So there's so many new things that are going to be coming forward for our colleagues, and so I think it really warrants that folks recognize that it's not just TURBT after TURBT after and BCG, more BCG. And if you can't get the BCG, you'll only have intravesical chemotherapy. You'll get there hopefully within the next, 6 to 24 months, we're going to have that proverbial embarrassment of riches, which I think is great. Great for our clinics and our decision-making, and really great for patients.
Neil, I'm going to ask a follow-up question to you. You have a nice pulse, I think, on urology in the United States and sort of the practice. Do you think urologists are ready for ablative therapies for intermediate risk bladder cancer? And what do we need to do to sort of get them ready if we do start to have approvals?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, really good question, because what's kind of embedded in it is, look, the cystoscope and the resecting of bladder tumors is sort of the urologist's stethoscope, right? That's what, we kind of all can do it, and we all pride ourselves on being really good at it, whether you're in a rural clinic or in a metropolitan center. And I think that given the graying of the world, the aging of the population, so more and more of these patients, and then we have a person power shortage of well-trained urologists. We truly do, right? And so there is that disconnect. More and more patients will need therapy. We have fewer physicians available to give it. Maybe some of that'll be met up, be supplemented by the APP population. But we even have supply chain and person power issues in ASCs and hospital systems. So if we can, then bring in an effective, clinically significant therapeutic that can be delivered via a catheter in the clinic, I think it will be very widely embraced. As opposed to maybe when I first started out in practice, it was like, man, I just want to have a day where I could just be in there TURing away, whether it's the bladder or the prostate. We've recognized earlier in our conversation that this is, a procedure that's very expensive for the healthcare system, but it actually does inflict a lot of morbidity on patients. And I think we don't always appreciate it, as and Katie articulated that. So I think, Max, I see a very quick and rapid adoption with approvals. As we've already seen with upper tract disease, with the use of the UGN product. So I'm very optimistic about it.
I think that's pretty exciting to hear. Neil, it's definitely something that I think about of what it is. And, you know, I've actually kind of been talking to over the last 6 months or even up to a year, you know, to some of my intermediate risk patients that say, is there anything else? I keep saying, wait around, you know, we have some things coming. There's some things in the pipeline and my story might be changing in the next 6 months. The next time you see me, I might actually, you know, have something different to offer you. And I think that's pretty cool. You know, and I think something that's important for us to remember as urologists is if you, you know, think of TURBT and what I tell my patients is, you know, I can do a very good TURBT just like many other urologists and I'm treating that tumor, but the exciting part maybe of some of these treatments are treating the disease, you know, and getting that durability. And treating a tumor versus treating a disease is probably a much different story in the long term for patients. And I think it's going to be impactful.
You know, I forgot to add, but, you know, we talk about the BCG shortage. I mean, we have had a hurricane come through the Southeast. We had saline shortages.
Yeah.
You know, well, we have sometimes anesthesia medication shortages. So if there are things that we can do in the clinic that takes burden when we have supply chain issues, That's a nice thing to have in our armamentarium.
Neil, I could say no urologist wants to do a TURBT with 250 cc bags of saline, and I had a week of that. It's not fun. Yeah. Let's pin you guys down a little bit. Okay, so give me an example of a recurrent low grade non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patient. We're going to do three categories. Category one is the patient that you're going to, both of you do a lot of biopsy and ablation in clinic. So that's category number one. Who's that patient? What's been their disease history? You know, who are they? Category number two, who's the patient that you're taking to the OR for TURBT? And patient number three, who's the patient that you are just sitting in anticipation of some type of ablative therapy to get approved because that's who you want to be treated. So three categories. I want each of you to give me that answer, Katie, and then Neil.
Cool. I'm going to start backwards because I just had this patient on the patient that I'm going to wait for something and I'm waiting for the ablation. He's on anticoagulants, which is not a big deal. I can still do an office fulguration, but continually has recurrent tumors at the bladder, neck, and around his left ureteral orifice that caused me just enough struggle in doing biopsies and fulgurations in clinic. That's very annoying. He has a big prostate. So, you know, even just getting that, it's, you know, I end up with blood somewhere in some point in form. And I think that he is an excellent candidate for chemoablation. With all of that, I've tried many times, he's had this for years, to say, oh, let's just, you know, come back and see me in a few months. But he and his wife have a lot of anxiety related around this, right? The word cancer, as much as I have, or the word recurrence, tried to walk them back off the cliff as to what that word means in his setting, can't wrap their heads around it, right? So when I see something that could be something early, they're ready for me to jump on it. This guy has no business going back to the operating room every 3 months, which is what would happen, right? And office fulguration based on location is tough. Office fulguration, I'm flipping back to your first one, is, you know, patients that have had multiple recurrences, it's a nice, you know, couple millimeter spots in the bladder that I can easily, you know, I still biopsy them. I remove it and debulk it as much as possible and fulgurate it. And then really, I'm pretty aggressive with the fulguration. So my TUR patients will probably become less as I get something else that's office-based with a chemoablation. But TURs are really location, bladder, neck, really anterior locations that I just can't get to with a flexible scope, or up a, you know, and just don't tolerate it. I do have a couple of women who just can't tolerate, you know, any fulgurations down near the trigone.
Well, that was great. Super comprehensive. Yeah. A start, you know, for, so maybe A, the biopsy folges. I'll, you know, I typically don't, I'm not too happy about going more than 5 to 7 millimeter. So, and if I can, if they're in manageable locations, I'm pretty happy to do that on a pretty regular and routine basis. And even some of them after they've recurred, I'll just watch them, especially older patients with comorbidities. I loved your comment about anticoagulation. Some days I think to myself, am I the only person in the world who's not anticoagulated? I mean, everybody's anticoagulated. And then the B, the TURBTs, you know, I look forward to, you know, approvals where I can offer everyone the opportunity for an ablative strategy. It's clear, you know, that, you know, are more frail or folks with comorbidities and who had multiple TURBTs, that's kind of a no-brainer. But even my younger, more fit patients, you say, you know what, I'm just really, I don't want anesthesia for whatever reason. That makes me nervous. Or, you know, I'm willing to come in for some form of intravesical therapy. You know, let's just do it and I'll go back to work and I'll figure that out. I love the idea of treatment options for patients and letting them decide. But there are patients who will say, look, you know what, I can't do the time for the weekly administration or whatever their dosing schedule is. Can you just go in and remove it? And I probably, especially first time patients presenting, certainly want to get that opportunity to think about that. And then, you know, getting back to the patients who, you know, they're not good candidates for biopsy folge. They're not good candidates for TURBT. They have multiple lesions, as the patient you were describing, big median lobes, and yet, you know, large lateral lobes, curvaceous posterior urethras, or they've had an anesthetic and they hated it, or they can't stand to go home with a catheter. Love the idea of being able to have an ablative therapy, drop the catheter in, give the therapy. Of course, it'll be our nursing teams that'll be doing it, freeze us up, have them get home. And hopefully it's a therapeutic that is easily stored, you know, packaged and delivered without a lot of complexity. I think that'll be important as well.
You mentioned Neil, that I can't help but to chime in, if you don't mind, Max, about the young patients and people just not wanting to go under anesthesia in the operating room. You know, patients are smart and they're, you know, reviewing all of the medications they get under anesthesia. They're asking all of the good questions. And that's one thing. But the other thing is, you know, they will often ask me when I'm going to do a TUR, how long is this going to take? You know, and I say, my part of the operation is 15 to 30 minutes, but we will waste your whole entire day, meaning you're going to have somebody drop your kids off or your grandkids off at school, somebody to pick them up. You're going to be sitting in our waiting room all day. I'm going to make you get there 2 hours early in case I'm running ahead of schedule or somebody else cancels. But then when I'm running behind, you're there 4 hours early. Like It will definitely impact your entire day and not just you, your whole family.
Katie, what about their anesthesia clearance with their primary care doctor? And they have AFib. And now they have to get a cardiology clearance.
Sure.
And, you know, the TURBT, you did a really good job. You got a lot of muscle. So they have a lot of spasms. So they're not going to work for the next 3-4 days.
Sure.
So I think we completely underappreciate the burden on our patients of a TURBT. We call it simple because it takes us 15 minutes. But when you do something like that under anesthesia, I haven't seen a paper like that. Maybe I'll try to get one of my trainees to look at it, but the number of days lost from work per average TURBT, I'd be fascinated to know. So I think that's such a great and underappreciated point. Wrapping up, just in closing, I really, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're all here, and that hopefully the people listening are here to give us, you know, resources and opportunities for better treatment for our patients, you know, suffering from this disease. Curious, you know, are there any resources that you share with your patients to support them on their treatment journey, both of you?
I send everybody to BCAN and the BCAN website. I hand them, you know, we have the BCAN booklets that I hand them out in clinic. And, you know, tell them that if they're going to go to the internet, to Dr. Google, only go to that, right? Don't read what any of these hospitals write, good, bad, but if you really want comprehensive, and then I encourage them to, you know, to really jump out there and get into an advocacy and, you know, their local network if they want to. You know, I think more of my high risk patients, you know, take me up on that offer, than the low risk and intermediate risk patients, for sure. But, I definitely guide them to BCAN right off the bat.
It's 100% ditto for me. I think BCAN is fabulous. They've got, you know, it's a nonprofit organization that's supportive of bladder cancer research and patient advocacy. And they have wonderful video testimonials for patients and the entire spectrum of and the journey of bladder cancer. Great information on trials and great information for sites that are, you know, really practicing state-of-the-art care. That's exactly what we do. And their handout literature, their pamphlets are really good for those who want them as well.
Well, this has been, you know, really fun to talk to both of you about. I think a really exciting area of all of urology, and I think something that it's obvious this group is really passionate about. So thank you for joining us today.